I think that the Anthropocene is really useful when it is used in many different ways. It brings people to the table to discuss their concerns, their interests, their understanding of how social change and humans are causing planetary change.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore biodiversity conservation and the environment more broadly, and interrogate conventional wisdom for the sake of a more robust case for conservation. I'm your host, Andre Marder. Humankind's transformation of the Earth is embodied in the idea that we're living in the Anthropocene. Most people who've heard of this concept were probably unaware that it describes a specific unit of geological measurement, an epoch. A debate has been ongoing for more than a decade about whether to make that designation official, for the Anthropocene to take over from the Holocene epoch. This debate concluded just a few weeks ago with a definitive no. In this episode of the Case for Conservation podcast, renowned Anthropocene expert Earl Ellis explains what happened to the Anthropocene and why it doesn't really matter that it was rejected as an epoch. Earl is an environmental scientist who divides his academic time between the University of Maryland in the US and Oxford University in the UK. He's a prolific author and public commentator on this and related topics. I asked Earl to begin with a bit of a primer on geological timescales to get us started.
Let's start with the Jurassic. So the Jurassic is a period of geologic time. And within periods, there are epochs. And then within epochs, there are ages. So those are three levels that are particularly relevant. The current period is the Quaternary period, and there are two official epochs in the Quaternary, the Pleistocene, which I think most people have heard of, and then the Holocene, which even though it is our current epoch, most people, I think, are not familiar with this term. And that's kind of important, the fact that most people have never heard of the Holocene. They've heard of the Anthropocene more likely than they've heard of the Holocene, because it really doesn't matter what epoch we're in. That's not actually the important part of the concept of the Anthropocene. It's not an official epoch, yet it's attracted a lot of attention and we care about it. But the actual epoch is not something that you need to know.
Right. Not for geological reasons, but more, I guess, sort of popular reasons. People know or are more likely to know what the Anthropocene is than the Holocene. But within those geological timescales, what is it, just to go back to the Holocene, what is it that distinguishes the Holocene from the Pleistocene, which went before it? And what's behind the calls to end the Holocene and start an Anthropocene epoch?
So the Quaternary is a period that is defined by these glacial interglacial cycles. It's a relatively cold interval in Earth history. And so there's more than 20 glacial interglacial cycles in the Quaternary. So the Pleistocene occupies most of the Quaternary, and it is characterized by these many glacial interglacial cycles. All the Holocene is it's the last one. It's the last interglacial interval, right? So it's basically the time since the last ice age, the last glacial interval. That's really all that's special about it. And I can tell you that there's actually a lot of geologists and others who think that the Holocene is a kind of meaningless unit, because it's not really in many ways any different than the other warm interglacial intervals in the past, other than it's the current one. And think about it this way. So geologic time is constructed. It imagines a kind of layering where things are created on top of others, right? The older stuff in theory is kind of at the bottom. Now the Earth gets all mixed up. And so the historical record of those earlier times is hard to find. It's often boiled down in the magma and popped back up again. It's no longer around. And so it's kind of rare, these earlier time evidence from the geologic time. And so that makes it hard to reconstruct the order of things. But the recent evidence is, we obviously know that this stuff on top is the most recent in almost all cases. And so reconstructing the Holocene, like we know where that is pretty easy. And even a lot of the Pleistocene, and only when you get down further in the Pleistocene do you start seeing stuff that's truly completely fossilized rock.
And what, I know this is getting sort of further from your area of expertise, but what distinguishes the Pleistocene from what came before that? So you said that the Pleistocene was characterized by these glacial and interglacial periods, but is that, what happened before that?
You are correct. You're getting to where my knowledge is thinner. I never work in the periods before the Quaternary. In fact, even the Quaternary for me is a very big unit. Before the Quaternary, we don't have any hominins, for example. Right. So the beginning of the Pleistocene is around we start to see some evidence of the hominins starting to evolve. But they're still just beginning then. You know, they're basically monkeys, not even really apes.
Okay. But do you think that is what defines the Pleistocene, the presence of hominids, or not necessarily?
There's often some relationship in terms of who's interested in the material evidence of geology, and people who reconstruct biological evolution use the geologic record. And of course, in more recent times, we have archaeological records and geologic records mixed together. And so archaeologists and anthropologists are interested in the evolution of, say, hominins and humans. They're also interested in Pleistocene types of evidence, right? For dating purposes, you know, what layer is this from what time, right? Because it's difficult to reconstruct those past times. There's very little evidence, very different than the very top, where there's super large amounts of evidence. It's all there, basically.
There's now been these calls for, and I read that I think it goes back to maybe the 1970s or thereabouts, the idea that what we're now living in is no longer the Holocene, but the Anthropocene. And I don't know much about the history behind that. I just know it goes back a few decades, but then more recently, there's been a more formal process, right? So what's behind the whole idea of ending the Holocene and starting an Anthropocene?
Well, to be clear, the Holocene has not been around forever as an official time unit. It's actually a relatively recent one. And there's been ideas about a human age, a geologic time with humans that is earlier, that goes back thousands and thousands of years, more toward evolutionary intervals of history for humans, like the Anthropogene and these other concepts. Because remember, geologic time, the way it's organized, is a kind of set of organizational principles. It's not itself a fact. It's just a way of organizing the facts. And so a long time before this century, we already had proposals to recognize a time in Earth history that is shaped by human societies. So that's not new to even the last few decades. But of course, with the evidence just becoming more and more clear of how much human societies are transforming the functioning of the whole planet, the calls to recognize this formally in Earth history have increased. And then in 2000, you have a little spark from Paul Crutzen, a sign of frustration with the current geological time organization, criticizing the Holocene, saying we're not in the Holocene, we're in the Anthropocene. And we are. I think anyone who thinks that we live in the last, warm interglacial, right? That warm interglacial, if there was nothing else going on, humans did not exist, we'd already be sliding into the next glacial interval. That's not going to happen. We are out of the Holocene. Likely we're out of the Quaternary, right? These glacial interglacial cycles, are they going to continue? We don't know. But I can't imagine functioning human societies at the scales that we have now would tolerate another ice age. And even without doing anything, we've already headed it off. So we're really out of the Quaternary already. So anyway, so that was the call in 2000 to just recognize it. And Paul Crutzen himself in his publications, his early ones, he said it began basically with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and he said to put a more precise time to this would be arbitrary. Right? These are his words.
And more precise than saying the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, because that's pretty precise already, isn't it? That's kind of within a decadal time scale.
Some people put it, 100 years apart. But yeah, within a century, you are going to pinpoint the Industrial Revolution. But the Industrial Revolution is not a precise event that just begin and after. And this has a lot to do with how to understand this argument that's been going on now about whether to formalize the Anthropocene as an epoch. This idea that the change is not all at once at a planetary scale, anything like that cannot be recognized in the geologic timescale, cannot become a geologic unit like an epoch. You have to have these clean breaks. And the term of art is diachronous. If the changes are occurring different places in the world at different times and to kind of build up to a change, that's a diachronous change. And this is an interesting thing that I rediscovered is I look back at the vote we had in 2016 in the Anthropocene Working Group about whether to formalize the Anthropocene as an epoch and how to do it. One of the questions was, is the Anthropocene diachronous? Which literally should have met is basically a vote no. There cannot be an epoch because the Anthropocene is diachronous. Paul Crutzen voted diachronous in 2016, as did all the people who rejected the Anthropocene epoch formalization in 1950.
Uh-huh. So Paul Crutzen voted diachronous, but he also voted that this should be called the Anthropocene. So kind of contradictory.
Oh, not just that it should be called the Anthropocene. We can call it the Anthropocene without having an epoch. We've been doing that for 20 years. Hasn't been a problem. The name implies an epoch because that name scene can only be applied to epochs. For example, if the Anthropocene is a period, it could not be called the Anthropocene. It would have to be called something else.
Mm-hmm. So there was this proposal to officially change what we call our current epoch from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. And this was recently, very recently, rejected by the international body responsible for making such decisions. So you've already hinted at it, but why was it rejected? And what's your view on that rejection?
Well, I think it's public knowledge that I am relieved by this rejection because I was very concerned by what the proposal had become. And when we started talking about formalizing an Anthropocene epoch, we started the official process, I think, 2009, but really the ball really got rolling around 2011. So we've been working on this for a very long time. And it was a very open-ended kind of process. We weren't trying to finalize this, you know, very firm date. Although the Great Acceleration was always and should be recognized as one of the most important events to think about when we think about human transformation of the planet. This is this great acceleration and changes of many kinds across the planet that starts around the mid-20th century. But there were all these other parts of the Anthropocene that were all discussed, all investigated. But when it comes down to the formalization process, in order to have a vote and to insert an Anthropocene epoch at the top of the timeline that would end the Holocene epoch, or even remove it or change it to another name, although bureaucratically, we did not have the right to do that. We could only work on the Anthropocene epoch. The Holocene is another group. Anyway, so basically, we've been trying to work on the Anthropocene epoch. And most of that time, we did kind of treat it as a diachronous thing. But the need for a golden spike, this kind of marker, GSSP, that would define kind of the before and after. In order to have a proposal, you had to have that. And as the focus went to that, which was like the last, say, 5 years or so, the focus was, what is that marker? You know, it gets more and more technical, more and more limited, more narrow definition of the Anthropocene. And what we ended up with is 1952 marked by a plutonium spike from hydrogen bomb testing in the sediments of a single lake in Canada, the Crawford Lake. Now, there are some other sites that are kind of alternative sites that are also part of the definition. You have to have two alternatives. I know one of them is a lake. I forget what the other one is. But the bottom line is that becomes the definition of the Anthropocene itself. So when we talk about the Anthropocene, we'd be talking about 1952 and after. And just so you know, the way that all these intervals of time worked, remember, this is geology. They're actually not timekeepers. They're trying to organize the material history of the Earth, the rocks, That's what they're really focused on. And so every time interval has a series, and this is the material record itself. That is actually what is being defined here as the material records. And so, for example, with an age, you also have a stage, and the stage is the material. So with Crawford Lake, for example, it's 6.5 centimeters of sediment, something like that. It's this thin little band. That's the Anthropocene, defined as an epoch.
Right. But so what confuses me here is I thought that you were going to say that that 1952 event was kind of chosen as the potential marker because it sort of left a mark worldwide. And I think I've even heard that years ago. I heard that this plutonium was detectable all around the world. Is that the case? Because you mentioned now that it was just this Canadian lake. And so it is potentially...
But when you say detectable... Uh-huh. That's the challenge here, is in what way? Mm-hmm. Okay. And for example, the ultimate place to leave a geologic record is ocean sediments, right? So many of the series are defined in ocean sediment columns. But the reason they didn't do that is because the level of precision needed here. We're only talking this thin layer of sediment. Well, the nice thing about Crawford Lake for precision is that it's this lake that's very undisturbed. It's like this deep sinkhole. And so the sediments are laid down very precisely. You can even identify each year. In the oceans, the sediments turbate. There's organisms living in them. This is, oxygen-free sediments in Crawford Lake. And so there is detectable plutonium signal, but it's spread over a thick layer of sediment that is plus or minus about 50 years. And so if you're dating something 70 years old, unacceptable, according to the folks who were doing the stratigraphy work.
Right. So that was, I guess, a big part of the argument, right? The winning argument that should not be regarded as an epoch. And I guess in contrast, the beginning of even the Holocene would have been a lot more detectable.
Well, these are really big changes. I mean, there was 500 feet of ice sitting on top of New York City.
Wow.
In the glacial interval, the last one. So these are big changes on the Earth, even though, there's many of them in the Quaternary. This is the normal thing in the Quaternary to go in and out of these glacial interglacial cycles. But yeah, these are huge changes. You can see it in many different ways, river sediment changes. There's so many changes. But what was chosen for precision was ice. It's an ice core.
So I was also going to ask, but I think maybe this question is null and void now, whether there's any argument that the Anthropocene should be considered as a new period or a new era. But what about like an age, for example?
So that was an alternative strategy. But to be clear, right, it could not be an Anthropocene age.
Oh, right. The name would have had to change, right?
So basically, the proposal was Anthropocene epoch with a Crawfordian age.
Named after the lake that you mentioned.
That's usually how they name them. They name them after the place where the marker is, the material evidence.
Right. And how important do you think it is that we decide once and for all? So you said you're happy with the decision, but presumably there are those who are going to continue to push the argument. I mean, it's not dead now, is it? Or where
I don't
are we?
Think it should be. I think we should be discussing these subjects indefinitely. I don't think there's any reason to stop trying to formalize an Anthropocene epoch. I think this particular project didn't succeed, but the Anthropocene is going to be with us for as long as there are people, as far as I can see. And so there's every reason to be thinking about this concept of how we better understand the planetary changes that we're making. And so I have no problem with people investigating that in every possible way. The only thing I was relieved about here was that this particular limited, narrow definition of the Anthropocene is no longer possible to become official, at least in the short term. I mean, the ICS could easily commission another Anthropocene working group. I believe it's official already. I haven't announced this, but the original Anthropocene working group should at this point be officially disbanded. And so if there's going to be an Anthropocene working group, it would have to be reformed. But I see no reason why they couldn't try to do an Anthropocene period group. It would have to have either a different name or the charge of the group would be to come up with a period name to define what we're talking about here. But this is kind of a sideshow for the real science, right? The real science of the Anthropocene has always been trying to understand the global changes that people are the global consequences of human societies on the planet. That's the subject, that's the science. And this is kind of a kind of organizing information kind of sideshow to all that. Like, how do we put this into this other system? But as we said, right, like nobody even knew that they were in the Holocene epoch. People don't think in epochs very much. It's not that useful for us. And so, you know, formal Anthropocene epoch is really, again, a sideshow to the bigger picture of the science of the Anthropocene.
So it sounds like it's sort of a confusion that's going on that sort of, I guess, especially the general public and environmentalists and conservation biologists would want to have something like the Anthropocene to use as a tool, you know, a narrative tool, but it doesn't, as you've explained now, it doesn't jibe with how geological time works and how these markers work, right? Like, so it seems to be kind of like a two different worlds that are kind of clashing here, and both very important. But as you say, the one is about organizing materials and the other one is about, I guess, making arguments, you know, policy arguments, because that's, I guess, the most valuable tool that something like an Anthropocene could fulfill. So with that in mind, then, you know, the Anthropocene is not, the fact that it's been rejected as an official geological timescale means that it's kind of lost a lot of its clout, I guess. So what do you think that means for environmentalists, for example, who've been using this, you know, as a tool, as a narrative tool? Because opponents would then say, oh, this thing's been rejected. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
I mean, I said this to another reporter. I said, keep calm and carry on. It's still the Anthropocene. Nothing has changed. Literally nothing has changed. You could even say the Anthropocene remains a proposed geologic epoch. It still is. It just isn't an official one. It's been that way for 20 years, and it's been very useful. It's been very useful, and it continues to be useful. We continue to deepen our understanding of what the Anthropocene means, continues to gain new narratives that help us communicate the science of global change. Nothing has changed. I think the most important thing for people to do is just realize this was never the big show. This was always a sideshow. And the real science and utility of the Anthropocene as a concept for science and society rolls on. The Anthropocene lives. It's still a critical concept. And this is not really an important part of the Anthropocene.
But then why do you say that you're relieved that the working group came to the decision that they came to? Why is that a good thing?
Well, simply put, this very narrow definition of the Anthropocene, as starting in 1952, marked by bomb testing, that would become this very powerful narrative that would add in to all the narratives people are already using. And I think it's the most narrow definition, I think, that's out there. And Anthropocene should not be narrowly defined. It is a broad, inclusive concept, and it needs to have depth. It can't just be a shallow layer of sediment. It needs to include the whole process of transforming the Earth, not this kind of just little bomb blast and acceleration that happened in the blink of an eye, actually, geologically. It's much bigger, much more important concept than that. So what concerned me is that would suck all the air out of the room. Right? The Anthropocene begins in 1952. Now that doesn't have to be the way we talk about the Anthropocene, just like it hasn't been the whole time. I mean, when I talk to people about the Anthropocene, almost nobody, and I'm talking about scientists, ecologists, and they've never heard of the idea that the Anthropocene begins in 1950. That's just like, that doesn't make sense to people for good reason, right? You have to explain to them in an elaborate way why anyone would even say it does, right? They think of it more as a few hundred years usually. Or maybe deeper, but nobody thinks 1950. So in other words, we can continue to use the narratives and understandings that we've had for decades about this.
And I guess what you're saying also is that we should be able to apply that idea of Anthropocene to the last, since the Great Acceleration began, or since the Industrial Revolution began, or since human beings started to have a major effect on ecosystems, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, right? Like it should be applicable to any of those, depending on you know, how you want to use it.
It applies to all these processes of planetary change. But that's how people are really using the idea. It represents this time of people causing change. And sometimes people specialize it, you know, they call it the capitalist scene or these other kinds of ideas about the processes of change. And there are not just one, right? There's many processes of social change that are causing planetary change. But this bigger subject of the Anthropocene is about that bigger idea. And it's the big idea that really matters and is really moving things. And this very narrow idea of a 1952 Anthropocene marked in a few centimeters of sediment in this lake in Canada would have, in my view, kind of polluted the narrative. It would have made it harder to talk about the deeper implications of the planetary transformation.
So this is a bit of a petty and semantic point, but do you think it would make sense, or do you think there's any chance of a new term being used that does not attach itself to geological timescale? So you mentioned that that scene at the end of Anthropocene indicates that it's an epoch, right? Or supposed to be an epoch. So wouldn't the solution then be to just, you know, separate ourselves from geological timescales and the Latin that goes with them, and, you know, just come up with something entirely new? I guess the thing is that Anthropocene has just developed a following now, right? It's been many decades that it's been used, so it would be difficult to replace it.
Well, I can tell you, I know a fellow scholar who has compiled a list of scenes, you know, like Capitolocene. The list has more than 200 entries. There are so many different types of change that are attached to the concept of a scene or an Anthropocene or geologic changes in the planet. And I don't actually, I mean, for a while there, I've kind of found it annoying, this kind of overabundance of terminology that people are inventing, and you can't even keep track of it all. But on the other hand, I think it's a way that people are attaching themselves to the idea of social change as a process of planetary change. And I think that subject is what the Anthropocene has made popular and understandable, and is connected with so many people, so many scholars. And I think it's important, I think, that this idea. So whatever ways that it gets out there, I think is somewhat helpful, even if some of them maybe are narratives you want to oppose. It's still good to have the discussion.
Right. And Earl, do you worry that, it's kind of going back to one of my earlier points, do you worry that the fact that, you know, it's made the news now that Anthropocene has been rejected as an epoch, or as the name of an epoch, are you concerned that that news might dampen? I mean, you said that you'd mentioned to a reporter that they should keep calm we should all keep calm and carry on. But do you think that will happen? Because just sort of thinking about the way that the media works, you know, something like that will be kind of picked up and, you know, styled however the media want to style it. And I'm just wondering what this will mean for the future of a term that has, as you've said, performed a very important function so far.
It's very hard to say what the media and popular understanding will do over time about anything. And in this example, it is something I was concerned about. In fact, this idea had never occurred to me or the other scientists I work with, as far as I know, until this first meeting in London in 2011 with all the people who became members of the Anthropocene Working Group. A reporter asked us at that time and said, what happens if the Anthropocene is not officially put into the geologic timescale? What about that? And I had no answer at all. It never even occurred to me that was possible, because it's so obvious that we live in this human transformed age. Like, why wouldn't the geologists adopt that right away? What's the hard part here? And it was before I knew much about how geologic time is organized and the kind of evidence that's used. And after learning that, my view started to change. But the bottom line is, we've been thinking about that for a while. What happens if the official Anthropocene epoch is not approved? And it wasn't. But before that, we've been preparing another way for geologic science to describe the Anthropocene as a phenomena. Very simply, we just use this term event, geological event. And that term is very broad. It doesn't require a very clear beginning. The biggest example of that, that people who are familiar with Earth history are all familiar with, is the Great Oxidation event, which did not occur all at once in one place in the world or across the world. It's this more complicated, longer-term process that has many different stages to it. And nobody really cares when is the exact time when the Great Oxidation event began. It's more important to understand the process of change, which really changed the entire functioning of the Earth completely. And we don't know how big the changes are that human societies will make. They're already very significant. I think it's significant enough to have ended the Quaternary, because we're not going to have another ice age anytime soon. But how big are they? They're unlimited almost. We don't know. It depends on what human societies do.
Just to bring biodiversity into it a bit, as far as I understand, one of the criteria, I guess you would say, that defines a geological period, or not, sorry, I didn't want to use any particular...
No, it's hard to use these terms casually, like era.
Yeah, what's a general word that applies to all of them?
Interval.
Interval, okay. So one of the criteria that's used to describe and to identify these intervals is a change in species composition, as far as I understand, or at least in the case of mass extinction events. Like,
it's very common to use fossil species to identify these different stage or intervals. And many of them involve extinctions, as you said, but some of them involve a new creature showing up.
Right. So I'm just thinking, with that in mind, we all know that we're now undergoing we're heading for a sixth mass extinction.
I'm going to push back on that and say, if human societies continue to do exactly what they're doing now, mm-hmm. it would take centuries to get to a mass extinction. Mass extinction means about more than half. Some people say more than 75% of species have to go extinct. We are so far away from that. Now, vertebrates, which people really care about because we're vertebrates, I think, is part of it. They're more in trouble than a lot of other taxa on the planet. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that, yes, we are heading in the wrong direction. We are causing more and more extinctions. If we continue down this path, terrible future is possible. But the idea that we're already in a sixth mass extinction is a terrible message, because I think it's almost inevitable that we are not going to continue to drive extinctions at these rates. We are already starting to bend the curve. We're not necessarily ever going to have a mass extinction. So the idea that we're in a mass extinction is disempowering. It says you can't do anything because we're already in an extinction. If we're really already in the extinction, what are we supposed to do? Nothing. Just let it roll out. Do not believe we're in the sixth mass extinction. Believe that we need to push back on the acceleration in extinctions that we are causing. That's critical. If you want to save biodiversity, we need to do that. But the message that we're in a sixth mass extinction is disempowering and not factually correct. Concern is growing. There's so much evidence that you know, we're working toward bending this curve.
Right. But I was just wondering, so the question, there are a couple of things in there, and we've covered one of them, but the main reason I brought it up was I was just wondering whether the loss of species, which is already at sort of, you know, a couple of orders of magnitude higher than the normal rate, is that not something that would be detectable in the geological record in, you know, millennia to come? Could you not look back on this period of time, even if we do manage to turn things around, and see, well, something happened here, something big happened here, because a lot of species disappeared at this time?
Definitely. It'll definitely be evidence. It might be a little hard to detect. Most of the geological evidence that uses fossils tends to be marine, not terrestrial. And terrestrial surfaces are not the best places for accumulating deposits of geologic time. And you need those series to do that. But let's say it's a billion years from now. And let's say for the next few hundred years, people didn't do anything about extinctions, just the process kept accelerating. Yeah, it could become a mass extinction that would be visible, and it would look a lot like the others. It would take a few hundred years. It doesn't happen in a day. I mean, some of them are faster than others, but it would look like a blip in time. A century is not a long time in geologic terms, and a billion years, a century is nothing at all. And so, yeah, it could look like that. But even without, let's just say we bend the curve, we will still see, even 1,000 years isn't a long time. We would see the Pleistocene extinctions too, because they were pretty significant extinctions. You lost these megafauna that were capable of actually maintaining whole biomes, like the mammoth steppe. You know, you have these very big changes. People contributed to those extinctions. They did not cause them as the only cause, right? There was a lot going on at that time, but people contributed. It's part of the process of change. It's actually one of the things that also differentiates the Pleistocene from the Holocene is the loss of those species. That's why people have heard of the Pleistocene, because there's these really cool megafauna in the Pleistocene that we don't have anymore.
But then why is it necessary? Why has the discussion been about pinning an Anthropocene down to a particular time or date? Because presumably the previous epochs and periods were not very clearly defined, right? I mean, those dividing lines between them could have spanned thousands of years, right? So why has there been the argument, the Anthropocene argument, to pin it to a particular year or a particular event? Couldn't we just say, look, we are in an Anthropocene now, but we don't know exactly when it started. It's just, it started somewhere within the past few thousand years.
I mean, I think that is the way to think about the Anthropocene, exactly that, right? We're in the Anthropocene. There's no question about it. When exactly did it begin? It's not really important to know that. And it's not really a good question, right? It's been rolling out and increasing in strength and reach and transformative force for a long time. But stratigraphers love precision. I can tell you that the lead stratigrapher on the Crawford Lake site, but the one who's in the Anthropocene working group, Martin Head, he was excited by the prospects that they might actually be able to date the Anthropocene to a season within a year. And for people who study stratigraphy, that's an exciting capability scientifically to be able to date with such precision. But I would argue it's completely a meaningless thing to understand the Anthropocene, to have a seasonal or single year definition of the Anthropocene. Again, that was part of my concern about this whole idea of formalizing the Anthropocene as an epoch starting in 52. It's too narrow. It diminishes the understanding of what we're talking about. It doesn't add to it.
Yeah, I completely understand that, but I'm still kind of wondering, why couldn't we just say we are in a new epoch? It's called the Anthropocene, but we're not going to say exactly when it started.
Go ahead and do that. It's not a problem. I have no problem. Crutzen had no problem at all with this idea. Uh-huh. He just moved right ahead and the idea went out into the world and it started to change people's thinking, and it's still doing that. And I hope it will still continue to do that long after this kind of very narrow debate and voting process is over.
Okay. So the voting process was specifically to pin it down to a particular date.
It's about creating a golden spike to mark it in the geologic time scale. Nothing else.
Right.
That's all that group can do. And it's a very interesting thing to try to do it. I have no problem with trying to do it. I think it would be cool to see another Anthropocene working group. Like I said, maybe even at the period level. It's an interesting thing to keep studying it. We learned a lot. We learned, for example, that plastics could become a marker. That was a totally novel thing that I think emerged from the work of people in the Anthropocene working group. A lot of cool ideas, a lot of new scientific methods, etc. It's good to practice this stuff. It just, the pinning it down to a certain year doesn't really have a whole lot of utility for anyone and can actually shape the message about what the Anthropocene is about in the wrong direction, to narrow it down rather than broaden our focus on the task ahead.
Do you get the feeling that the Anthropocene is generally used pejoratively, perhaps outside geological circles? I'm not sure. Within geology, I guess it's much more of a technical term, sort of an emotionless term. But at least among conservationists and environmentalists, I sometimes wonder if this sort of pejorative use belies a lack of appreciation of what human beings have achieved. It's used very negatively. And I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's something that irks me a bit. And I was wondering if it irks you.
Well, I think that the Anthropocene is really useful when it is used in many different ways. It brings people to the table to discuss their concerns, their interests, their understanding of how social change and humans are causing planetary change. That's when the Anthropocene is useful. And if some people want to come to the table with this very negative idea that all humans can do is destroy the planet, that's what they're thinking. And I think it's on everyone to change that narrative. And there's every possibility that a very negative future could be shaped by human societies. That's on the table, but it is not inevitable. There are so many signs that we can do so much better. The capabilities of human societies to change the world for the better have never been stronger. We are more interconnected, more interdependent, more capable of changing the world for the better than ever before. So the idea that the focus should only be on the fact that we have created a lot of negative consequences, mostly unintentionally. There's not a whole lot of people out there saying, I want to cause climate change. It's all an unintended consequence. We can work together to end these things, or at least move the needle in the right direction, bend the curve in the right direction. And I think that has been my focus in talking about the Anthropocene, is how much capability we have to do better.
In the next episode, we focus on Insectageddon, the idea that the world's insect populations are collapsing. Jane Hill is a lepidopterist, that's a butterfly expert, and president of the Royal Entomological Society, who helps to put this topic into a bit of perspective. I hope you can join us.